these are some of the cruelties of history and the cruelties of timing. And if you could have told Rustin and Horowitz and Randolph and Keiserling how this stuff would play out in 1965, maybe you could have got them to say, you know, okay, we're not going to argue about, you know, what images we're going to use in the Freedom Budget and just, you know, put this out ASAP and, you know, get on the line. They'd hope that Jacob Javits and Bobby Kennedy might sponsor it as a bill, you know, kind of, you know, work in that effort more significantly.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
My name is Chris Hong. I'm a PhD student at the University of Chicago Department of History, and I'm an intern at the Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, everyone. That voice you heard at the top of the episode was David Steins. David is UC President's postdoctoral fellow in the Department of African American Studies at UCLA. You may recognize it from the History of Capitalism podcast he co-ran for many years, titled Who Makes Sense. David's work there was one of the inspirations for us to start our own radio show, so we're really glad to have him on. For this episode, we read his dissertation, Fearing Inflation, Inflating Fears. It's about the politics and economics of unemployment from the 1930s through the 1970s, in the context of a racially stratified capitalist social system. By extending the story of the civil rights movement backwards into the Depression and forwards into the stagflationary 1970s, David tells a longer and more complicated story than the one many of us are used to. It blends social, political, labor, and economic history with African-American studies to make the case for the centrality of full employment to Black freedom politics. This is what drew me to the project and what I really hope we get to talk about today. The names, places, and times associated with the concept of full employment are mainly elite European, or at least white and male. David gives us a very different canon to work with. Feminists, civil rights activists, rank-and-file union members, who saw the promise of full employment as something more than just a technical goal or an efficiency criterion. Full employment meant something very different to a Black man looking for work in Jim Crow America than it did in the math textbooks passing themselves off as economics in the post-war period. So, like I said, I've been looking forward to this episode for a long, long time. Unfortunately, during the Zoom recording, I had the wrong microphone selected, so my voice sounds like hot garbage. So I re-recorded this intro, but we're here to listen to David talk, and thankfully his voice came through nice and clear. So, without further ado, David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
We're talking about maybe a good place to kick off the conversation would be to begin with some stage setting, in particular the first chapter, which really spans the Depression in 1929 through the Second World War. And I guess particularly, it seems like what you describe as a popular front structure of feeling that prioritizes, you know, the problem of joblessness and as a corollary, full employment during this period. Between the New Deal coalition, the broadly speaking U.S. left and labor really begins to coalesce in this World War II moment. And this is also where you talk about one of the heroes of the dissertation, which is Randolph, Philip A. Randolph. If you could speak to almost like the wartime origins, I guess, of the civil rights movement that, you know, achieves its high watermark after the war.
You know, one of the things that I think emerges from the wartime experience is belief and an understanding of what federal governmental countercyclical policy can do, and the ability of the federal government to both manage employment and manage inflation with fiscal and regulatory tools, which is to say, what was done during World War II of putting people to work and what was done with the Office of Price Administration and managing inflation, alongside large-scale social movements demanding safety, you know, economic safety from the violence of unemployment, the violence of deflation, and how, you know, the end of the war, the kind of, you know, post-World War I racist violence, we're talking on the anniversary of the Tulsa massacre. So the post-World War I, you know, racist violence and racial pogroms haunted people like Randolph, as well as some of other things that he witnessed during the, as the leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, things that he witnessed working alongside railroad workers, which were, you know, what basically a lynching ring of railroad workers, you know, as some kind of interpreted it as basically lynching railroad workers for their jobs, Black railroad workers for their jobs. And so one of the things Randolph learns in the Depression, this is somewhat crude, but I think, you know, communicates something, which is that he kind of goes into the Depression as more on the side of a class first socialist, and comes out of the Depression much more seriously about racial capitalism, how race and class co-articulate each other, and as he sees it, a kind of need to create a political economy that's hospitable to anti-racist struggle. Basically, in an environment of scarcity, to be is hospitable towards racism, alongside everything else going on during this period. He sees a federal governmental guarantee to a job and full employment as a key component of building post-war anti-racist democracy. And he's not alone. And for just so many people from all sets of political beliefs, a governmental guarantee to a job really becomes a kind of dominant moral value during that period. And it's never able to achieve hegemony per se, in the sense of being able to compel, say, the Southern Dixiecrats or people like Congressman William Whittington in Mississippi or Congressman Carter Manasco in Alabama. It's never able to compel them to pass the 1945 full employment bill.
But in the sense, they had like the same analysis that Randolph had, right? That like an environment of scarcity is conducive to racist violence. It's just that they thought that was good.
That's fair enough. You know, I think you could also say they saw economic precarity for farm workers and domestic workers as, you know, a key component of the status quo, and they wanted to, you know, sustain that status quo in their district. Someone like Whittington was a member of the Delta Council in Mississippi, which was the kind of core group of elite governance in the state. So that's where I think, you know, Randolph and this broader milieu fits in to both reflecting and helping to create this broader social warrant or dominant moral sentiment that robust full employment, you know, full employment is, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this a little later, but full employment for this group of actors and for many actors up until at least the 1970s doesn't mean what it currently means. You know, full employment meant an environment where everyone who wants a job can have a job, that there's, you know, relatively no involuntary unemployment. That definition is part of the story of the dissertation and the book, the kind of contest over how full employment would be defined. And so, you know, in our contemporary discourse, full employment has come to mean, you know, whatever level of unemployment economists deem necessary to keep prices stable, which, you know, wasn't how many activists and kind of social critics and economic policymakers would have used that term in, say, you know, 1946 or 1945, or even up to the 70s. You see Coretta Scott King's organization, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little later, contesting and debating how full employment was being defined.
So I guess following from that, on the question of kind of political strategy during this period, Would you say, and this may be a little bit too telegraphic statement to make, but would you say these early civil rights activists like Randolph, were they looking to the popular front politics of the Roosevelt administration and sort of the ability for left and labor to kind of push the Democratic Party towards being more friendly towards workers, even though the Roosevelt obviously had more than one concession to Southern Democrats, as you say, or do you feel like the left was more mixed perhaps in approaching this, I guess, foreshadowing perhaps of realignment?
Yeah, I guess I'd say they were part of this broader, you know, popular front. You know, there's a picture that I often use in teaching and lectures on the book of Langston Hughes holding up the famed CIO PAC poster that says "For full employment after the war" from 1944. And I think, you know, a group like that Randolph briefly helped found and then and led and then eventually left, which I write about, the National Negro Congress, was certainly part of what can be conceptualized as kind of a broader Black popular front. You know, some of those tensions, you know, really come apart after the Hitler-Stalin Pact and some of the kind of sharper divides between, you know, socialists and people in the Trotskyist milieu and communists aligned with the Communist Party USA.
And that's definitely one of the things that comes through the clearest in your dissertation is the influence of the socialist movement on early civil rights organizing.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's...
And then are bound up with, like, you know, global geopolitics, right?
Without a doubt. And I think one thing I worked really hard on in the book was to try and treat some of those issues of kind of Communist Party aligned activists, Socialist Party aligned activists, with a lot of care and non-sectarianism. One of my mentors, one of the advisors on the dissertation, said to me, explain the choices people made and the conditions in which they made them. Otherwise, you'll end up going either too soft or too hard on your historical actors. And I really kind of tried to carry that with me throughout the project, especially dealing with some of the more kind of complicated issues around sectarianism within the left.
So with that in mind, you know, your project was recommended to me by a few professors actually of mine, Catherine Ballou and Destin Jenkins, both independently said that I should check out your work. And it's been very helpful in thinking through some of this stuff for me. And the reason that I brought this up is because it's also clear how important theorists like Cedric Robinson or Sylvia Federici are for your work in thinking through racial capitalism and the connections between, you know, identity and material conditions. Can you talk about, like, how important they are? I know that you've actually done a lot of work on Cedric Robinson, for instance.
Without a doubt, especially, but his kind of moral and political vision has been something that's really inspired me, as well as, you know, the other thing that I should say is, you know, I came to this project as a Scot, coming out of African American studies and Black studies, you know, and I think tried to envision the field of Black studies as a critique of, you know, Western civilization broadly, as something that was, you know, robustly interdisciplinary and problem centric. And so, you know, there is a kind of methodological, I was joking earlier with you all, but there is a kind of methodological feralness to my project that is, I think, you know, wholly within a Black studies tradition that I, you know, kind of grew up within. And, you know, one of the things that experience empowers you or empowered me to do was engage all sorts of texts critically. And so when I began kind of like trying to scratch the surface of what went on in the 1957 through 58 recession, and, you know, suddenly began finding myself reading Federal Reserve meeting minutes of the Fed's Open Markets Committee, it was like, okay, like this is, it's difficult to get my bearings, but I have experience reading things that I've found it difficult to get my bearings with.
So I would characterize your methodology as not as feral, but as eclectic.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, does that like problem-oriented approach come out of, like, I don't know, an activist mindset?
I think so. I think it also comes out of, you know, just a, you know, within a kind of activist sensibility to figure out what's going on, and to figure out why certain things are happening and how. You know, you mentioned earlier Destin Jenkins, and, you know, one thing that reading Destin's book took me back to was how I learned about the municipal bond market, which was in anti-prison activism through organizations like Critical Resistance and the Coalition, California's United for Responsible Budget, which were, you know, contesting the use of lease revenue bonds to grow the California prison system in the mid-2000s. And so all that's to say, a kind of activist sensibility that demands we have to figure out what's going on in the world.
So as an activist, you know, if you're interested in the actual material conditions of power and whiteness and you know, racial domination, you immediately just hit a wall of money, and you have to follow it and into finance and into the centers of finance in the central banks. A large part of your work is about what you call Jim Crow monetary policy. These are two things that are not often linked. If, to the extent that the Federal Reserve has been historicized at all, you know, it's generally conceived of as like, you know, this elite technocratic thing that's just hovering, you know, above it all in Washington, and you get lost in the numbers very quickly. But as you point out, like, that filters down to the everyday level where people make history and make meaning in their lives. And in the context of a Jim Crow political system, it has a very particular meaning. So I was wondering if you could help our listeners understand these connections and, you know, what Jim Crow monetary policy was.
First, I'll say what it is and how I define it in that piece, which is anti-democratic decisions about interest rates and the role of central banking in general that undermine the power of the most marginalized working class people, and in particular, Black people. And so I argue that this arose during the kind of 1951 to 1965 period, where the Fed wins its independence from the Treasury Department, and that during that period, it would enhance and eventually supersede the Jim Crow political bloc as the most significant impediment to a full employment economy that provided jobs for all who wanted them. I think another way of thinking about this back through, you know, what I was talking about whiteness studies, and as well as Black studies, as well as what Destin Jenkins, I think, so well conceptualizes within the municipal bond market as what he calls the fraternity, how groups of elite white men make decisions, you know, among themselves, and how they act between themselves, and what their assumptions are, and what their norms are and procedures, as well as what they think are, what they believe violence to be. They, you know, whereas someone like Coretta Scott King or Martin Luther King or A. Philip Randolph would have seen, you know, racial unemployment as a form of violence. You know, say William McChesney Martin, the longtime head of the Federal Reserve, you know, might have seen that as the normal functioning of a balanced economy. And what type of social costs are tolerable and allowable, I think, need to be understood historically within, you know, particular sets of actors. So
good. Yeah. One kind of, that was me, one of our questions is like, what makes this different from just normal independent central banking? Right, like why call this Jim Crow monetary policy as opposed to just what central banks do, part of the normal functioning of capitalism? And I think you just answered it, right? Is that like you couldn't have done this in a robustly socialist country with social democratic executive control over a central bank, because what they consider to be normal is just very different. And in a world where many central bankers are from the South, don't really care about Black people or whether or not they have a job or, you know, can eat, they're fine cranking up the unemployment rate in order to make sure the economy is running correctly.
I think that's absolutely right. The two other things I'd say on that is there's an interesting question with regard to the history of central bank independence. Some of the scholars who have looked at the history of the Bundesbank, for example, have seen how, you know, the Bundesbank was the U.S. superintended the Bundesbank to be independent as part of a way to undermine the democratic process in post-war Germany. So I believe that's 19, 1947 or so. So I think, you know, you could look at that and say, see, this isn't Jim Crow. It's something else that kind of undermines democracy. And I think on another hand, you know, the kind of anti-democratic impulse still holds, but, you know, the kind of specificity of
the motives and implications and situations
of motives and implications is slightly different. The other thing that I think is important about Jim Crow monetary policy is to understand the perspective of working class Black people and how they might have interpreted and how they did interpret what was happening. The theorizations of Jim Crow power, as well as its opposition, that someone like Fannie Lou Hamer might have brought to bear. And so Hamer insisted that she was working on, quote, a deeper freedom with special priority towards economic justice and dignity. And so, you know, any attempt to undermine the efficacy of those efforts could have, and I think was, understood within a continuity of oppressive social relations. So if you said to Fannie Lou Hamer, if you said, oh, well, you used to, in the 1940s, unemployment was, you know, you couldn't find a job everywhere because Mississippi Congressman William Whittington, you know, organized with the farm bloc to vote against the full employment bill of 45. And then in 1957 or 66 or 73, you said, oh, well, now, you know, jobs are scarce because the Fed raised interest rates and you know, is not adhering to the implications of the 1946 full employment bill. I believe that someone like Hamer, as well as activists, you know, like Coretta Scott King, who did see this happening, would have seen that within that continuity of oppressive social relations, which is why I think, you know, Jim Crow monetary policy is an apt term to identify those phenomena, though obviously, you know, not without its kind of complications and definitional disputes, some of which I'm still, you know, working through. I'm not generally a fan of creating a new term, but I saw it fit in this instance.
Yeah, maybe to just jump back into, I guess, your chronology of the 50s, which is such a crucial decade, as you mentioned, you know, beginning with the Fed Treasury Accord, I think in 51, and then continuing through, you know, a period that I think is conventionally portrayed as kind of the golden age, I guess, of U.S. post-war capitalism. But you actually show that this was a period of tremendous, you know, capital labor strife, and especially around, well, the problems of reconversion, but also a sort of mini episode of reconversion, which happens with the Korean War and the Eisenhower recession. So yeah, maybe, and I guess, also the figure of Leon Kaiserling, who kind of becomes more important later on, but who really kind of comes into your story in the 50s. So yeah, maybe to help readers understand why this decade is so pivotal for the rest of your dissertation.
Yeah, I, you know, certainly when I set out to write the dissertation, I did not envision writing, you know, two chapters on the 1950s, but that's how these things happen. So yeah, I saw the 1950s as really, really important to understanding the history of class struggle, racial and political and economic struggle altogether. So one of the things that I saw when I went into the archive to try and understand the A. Philip Randolph, the March on Washington, and the Freedom Budget was A. Philip Randolph is talking about how devastating this 1957 through 58 recession was for Black workers. And I began to kind of see this 1957 through 58 recession, which has to a certain extent been forgotten or been eclipsed by the 1970s recessions. I think, you know, since I was working on the dissertation, people like Kit Smimo and Samir Santi and Gabe Winant have wrote an important article in, I believe, Critical Historical Studies talking about, you know, the 57 through 58 recession and the steel strike of 59. But, you know, people like, you know, Christina Romer had written a few economic history articles on it, but it's not something that there's a lot of historiography on. And
based on my reading of the historiography, you'd think that Volcker invented crashing the economy to cure inflation in like whole cloth in 1979, whereas in fact, pretty much every post-war recession was a mini Volcker shock.
I would agree with that, you know? Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I really saw, especially when dealing with some of the meeting minutes and the debates within the Fed's Federal Open Markets Committee around the interest rate hikes in 1956, that would, depending on what degree of force you want to give it, either catalyzed or, you know, helped catalyze the 1957 to 58 recession. Part of the internal debate within the Fed at the time was people looking back, in particular, Alan Sproul, who was vice chair of the Fed at the time, Alan Sproul, who had helped lead the Fed to its independence in 1951. And he was concerned that taking such a what he interpreted as audacious action to undermine the commitments made in the 1946 Employment Act, which, you know, at least nominally said that every federal governmental agency and institution needed to create maximum employment, needed to do its part to create maximum employment. And so Sproul worried in the meeting whether taking the action that, you know, Fed Chair William McChesney Martin wanted to do to raise interest rates, whether that would, you know, kind of create a response from the Eisenhower administration or other political leaders to say Fed independence has gone too far. It was a, you know, cool experiment, but we're pulling back the reins. That did not happen. You know, Martin's vision won out, and I think thereby you established a set of parameters that Volcker would then utilize in the late 1970s.
So you have in 1951 the Fed Treasury Accord, which formally establishes the Fed independence. 5 years later, they actually test it out. How is this actually going to play out? And they take a gamble that Eisenhower isn't going to do anything if they crash the economy to reduce inflation, or at least, you know, raise interest rates to potentially crash the economy to potentially reduce inflation, whatever they see the causal relations being. And they're right. Eisenhower lets it go. And that establishes the pattern that then goes on to produce Volcker, which everybody understands is, you know, a key moment in the defeat of labor, not just in America, but around the world. But between the two moments, 56 and 79, there's a whole series of defeats every time the Fed slows everything down. Right?
Exactly. And by the early 1970s, you know, there's even confusion at the Fed about whether they're bound by the Employment Act of 46 at all. You know, so for example, I was able to get a memo out from a FOIA request at the Fed, where Howard Hackley, the Fed's chief counsel, asked this question: are we bound by the Employment Act of 46? And you know, he says unequivocally we are, but you wouldn't know it, you know, and it means something. It's something meaningful that the Fed had to actually ask this question in the early 70s. And the only reason I knew about this memo was because, interestingly, in the 1990s, when there was a bill, in the early 90s, there was a bill to get rid of the Humphrey-Hawkins Full Employment Act. And Janet Yellen says, you know, actually, we have this memo from the 1970s that said we were not only mandated by the Humphrey-Hawkins Act to fulfill allow for maximum employment, we also have, you know, this the 1946 Employment Act. So this bill would need to repeal Humphrey Hawkins and the Employment Act of 46. And so it was, you know, Janet Yellen saying that in the 1990s in an FOMC meeting.
The lawyers
enlightened me to the existence that 70s memo, which then I could go get out from FOIA.
So real quick, maybe we should remind our listeners what the Employment Act of 46 was, because it didn't just bind the government to providing maximum employment, right? It had several goals.
Yeah, so it had several goals. Well, first, you know, we've kind of, you know, said this, but just to spell it out, was the Employment Act was the kind of compromise bill from the more visionary 1945 Full Employment Bill, which would have mandated the government to create, you know, jobs for all. And so the kind of pressure from some of those congressmen that I discussed earlier, Manasco and Whittington, they were able to scuttle that that robust 45 full employment bill, but not able to kind of contain the broader energy for something. And that's what helps create the Employment Act of 46, which, you know, charges the entire federal government with creating maximum employment and relative price stability, or purchasing power is the language that was actually used, which right. I think is important in terms of, you know, how some of these things have been subsequently interpreted. So there's, you know, other than the Council of the Economic Advisors.
The government is committed both to full employment, but also to stable purchasing power. And therefore, you know, if you have to sacrifice one for the other, you still have this kind of legal leeway, right?
Exactly. And there's not, you know, a kind of institutional path outside the Joint Economic Committee and the Council of Economic Advisors to really push, you know, it doesn't say empower the Department of Labor to, you know, start hiring people. Doesn't, you know, recreate a WPA, those sorts of things. And so I think it gives important footholds for activists and you know, certain politicians to kind of continue to agitate around. But it is not in itself.
Yeah. One of the key guys is in your dissertation is one of the first CEA chairs, Council of Economic Advisor chairs, Leon Kaiserling, who is a way more fascinating figure than I thought. I thought he was kind of this generic kind of like, yeah, you know, full employment's good kind of guy. You know, he debates the Friedman of the late 60s. But you show that he had like a roller coaster career where he starts out kind of like that. And then he becomes a cold warrior before becoming like a civil rights activist, you know, returning to his left Keynesian roots. Can you just tell us more about Kaiserling and how you came to this interesting protagonist?
Yeah, you know, he's an interesting figure. I came to him because he is one of, alongside the civil rights activist Bayard Rustin, the key author of the 1966 Freedom Budget for All Americans that the A. Philip Randolph Institute puts together. You know, one thing I saw with Kaiserling, which, you know, then became borne out in subsequent historical work, was I was like, this guy's kind of further to the left than I had imagined him to be, or prior scholars up to that point had understood him. He had often been understood as kind of this arch cold warrior, you know, a kind of, you know, poster figure for military Keynesianism. He's the guy who says as head of the Council of Economic Advisors, yeah, the military budget can be, you know, incredibly high. You know, there's relatively no limit to the military budget. So, you know, historians had focused in on some of those elements of him, not wrongly, but they missed other things that he did.
He was also the author of a co-author of NSC 68, kind of the blueprint for the Cold War, right? That's like the containment policy, you know, Bible, basically, right?
He was the kind of economic. He was the person who said, like, yeah, you can do this economically speaking,
right?
And I think, you know, so he's had this vexed role politically, people trying to understand, you know, where he would situate himself.
Right. But what was I saw in the archive, time story, or was he always kind of a military Keynesian guy?
I think it's a complicated story. You know, he, you know, helps write the Wagner Act in 35. He helps write the Full Employment Bill of 45, and then the Employment Act of 46. And then he's really, you know, struggling against what would become Fed independence. And yet at the same time, he sees what is economically possible. So he was, you know, on the ground witness to what was economically possible in the 30s and 40s. And he's also
maybe he conceded the military budget's capacity for expansion because of his general commitment to the capacity for expansion on the federal deficit.
Perhaps, you know, okay. I think some of these things are really hard to read, especially, you know, because of, you know, by the early 1950s, his wife, Mary Dublin Kaiserling was facing a Senate investigation under the broader kind of second Red Scare McCarthyist ethos. And so there's a sense that he might have been trying to, or, you know, I've wondered, you know, to what extent he was trying to cover over some of his politics. And this is some of Landon Storrs discovers in the second Red Scare and the unmaking of the New Deal left, is how broader McCarthyism swept up socialists, social democrats, anyone with any kind of like left thinking or left liberal thinking within DC. That was the broader the rise of the second Red Scare really kind of swept up people of all political persuasions, and so that became something important. And one thing Storrs uncovers
so it's like
how
it's a version of what would later be called hippie punching.
Yes,
you want in order to be taken seriously, you want to differentiate yourself.
I think you see that with Kaiserling, but I think you show in your dissertation, yeah, this broader movement of the non-communist left, right? So the SPA kind of burgeoning social democratic movements. And I think A. Philip Randolph too, to an extent, right? I think there's a definite tension there, which is, you know, broadly we can, under the umbrella of Cold War liberalism or perhaps military and Keynesianism, but these socialist leaning figures recognize that one way to, you know, attack, you know, the American security state, garrison state, whatever you want to call it, is kind of through the military institutions themselves. Whether that's, you know, desegregation, which is what I think A. Philip Randolph was an early proponent of, or sort of, if you're Kaiserling, using using the federal budget to, yes, spend on the military, but also he wanted to expand, I guess, these social spending programs, right? To, as you document, kind of early version of green investments, but also kind of these more non-military sectors as well.
Very much so. And so I think, you know, it's difficult to know how far to, you know, how to categorize someone like Kaiserling, who was perpetually kind of covering over his, you know, true or what may have been his true political commitments under these conditions, as someone who's very much a political actor, you know, as opposed to some other kind of economic policymakers who have a more robust research profile outside of DC. Kaiserling's very much a political animal, and the way he finds himself to the civil rights movement is he had kind of hoped he could go into the Johnson administration. And when the Johnson administration passes him over for Walter Heller those who Galbraith would kind of, John Kenneth Galbraith would call more reactionary Keynesians, Kaiserling says, well, I'm going to talk about the same things I always talk about, which is, you know, full employment, how to achieve it, and so forth. And that's where the kind of partnership between him, Rustin, and Randolph gets created in the 1960s. But, you know, to give you a sense of, you know, where he was politically, you know, I did an oral history with the great historian Thomas Dublin, who was the nephew of Mary Dublin Kaiserling and Leon Kaiserling. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, it wasn't until I read Landon Storrs' book that I had some kind of inkling of the kind of where my uncle was at politically. And that, you know, in his estimation, he didn't experience his uncle as far to the left as Landon Storrs did, or say, you know, as A. Philip Randolph did. And I think, you know, similarly, I did an oral history with Jamie Galbraith, who worked alongside Kaiserling in the 70s and, you know, he portrays Kaiserling as a real, you know, guy running up and down, you know, the Senate and House of Representatives halls, kind of striking fear into legislators with his reports on full employment and how to create it.
I found it charming reading your dissertation, just how peeved he was at the 1964 Revenue Act. Like, it was almost as if that was the single event that radicalized Kaiserling.
Very much. You know, I think Kaiserling, you know, one thing that comes through in reading his papers is he was incredibly dedicated. He's also, you know, a man with a lot of pride and a lot of bordering on arrogance. And I think that also kind of powered him to, you know, do what he could in the way he thought it should be done. But, you know, I have letters from him to Bayard Rustin up through, you know, in the early 80s saying, you know, we should have never abandoned the freedom budget, things like that. He's a really interesting political and historical figure, as is his wife, Mary Dublin Kaiserling. I've contemplated, you know, one day perhaps trying to write a dual biography of the two of them.
Oh, that'd be great.
That'd be very cool.
Yeah, you know, she was like a consumer activist, right?
She was a consumer rights activist who was perpetually, you know, was like him, part of this broader New Deal left, and, you know, worked with the National Women's Bureau in the 60s and 70s, and an important economic and political thinker in her own right.
You mentioned Rustin and Randolph and the work that they did with Kaiserling. And this is like a key, and really, I thought, you know, we've touched on a little bit, but really fascinating part of your dissertation is just how, you know, the approach that those three and others working with them took to over the arc of the 60s and maybe even beyond. But could you just describe a little bit about, you know, both what their strategic vision was and then also how they went about sort of pursuing that?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that happened, so they organized the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and they're centrally trying to win governmental guarantees to jobs for all. And, you know, in fact, you know, one of the early titles of the march is the Emancipation March for Jobs, Emancipation because it was on the 100-year anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. And when they link up with Dr. King, that's where they kind of add in this freedom. That's how we get the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. But the jobs component is really central to Randolph and Rustin. And it's the relative disregard for that jobs portion from LBJ and the broader congressional establishment in crafting what would become the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, that puts Randolph and Rustin in the situation where they say, you know, it's not enough to just march to DC with placards in our hand. We need to march with placards in one hand and model legislation in the other. And they want, and that's what they want the freedom budget to be, right? They want it to be that model legislation for robust public spending, for guaranteed jobs for all who want to work, guaranteed income for those who are, you know, unable to work for a variety of reasons, as well as, you know, national health care to address housing. And, you know, another thing that's kind of pushing them along is, even in 63, a fear of urban uprisings and urban unrest. And, you know, one, Rochelle Horowitz, who coordinated all the travel for the March on Washington and was, you know, a mentee of Rustin's and worked closely on all these issues, she told me that one of the reasons that the march was planned for the end of August was to give people an outlet at the end of the summer to kind of direct their energies towards, in an attempt to stave off any uprisings or riots that they interpreted as potentially detrimental to the cause of civil rights. And so they were, and part of the reason for that is, you know, Randolph had been on these riot commissions from the 30s and the 40s. And they also, you know, had a pulse of what was going on in Black communities in the North, Midwest, and West. And they, you know, could see how they could see the dearth of actual full employment in action, you know, in those communities. And so, you know, that was, you know, a big component for them. And they were, you know, those fears were proved correct, you know, in 19. Let me.
All right. So just FYI, listeners, we are switching microphones for David. So the voice is changing, but the ideas are the same.
You know, those fears were proved correct in 1964 when uprisings break out in across the U.S. and then to an even greater extent with the Watts uprising in 1965. And so, you know, again, Randolph, Rustin, this milieu sees governmental guarantees to jobs, robust full employment as an antidote to the kind of kindling that's created those racial conflagrations and those uprisings. You know, these are lifelong committed activists. You know, they see themselves in a long, long struggle. It wasn't like either they lose or they win something with the March on Washington, and then they just go home and retire, right? They're like, what did we win with the March on Washington? We won the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65. Now we continue, right? So that's part of this broader, their broader milieu and their broader tradition that they need to be contextualized within.
What you're really getting at there is sort of this broader movement for realignment, that sort of seeing the civil rights movement being kind of folded into a workerist kind of democratic socialist politics, right? I was reading a history of this of the Socialist Party of America, and I think Norman Thomas, you know, stalwart, I think he attended the march, and then in the days after the 1963 march, there were a series of conferences in Washington, and I think he said that, you know, this was the proudest moment of his political career is what was the march, which I think is really missing in a lot of, I guess I'm not an Americanist, but I remember learning about the civil rights movement in history and the march in Washington and this kind of powerful kind of the socialist roots of this movement is really I don't remember learning about that at all, unfortunately, but I think your dissertation really reaffirms this convergence of forces on the American left.
Yeah, there's a debate within the socialist milieu in the late 50s and early 60s about whether to kind of try and form a labor party or to try and realign the Democratic Party pushing out the Dixiecrats and creating the Democratic Party as a kind of de facto labor party. And some of the people I look at, like Horowitz, who I mentioned earlier, and her best friend, Tom Kahn, who also worked closely with Rustin, they're key people in some of these debates and thinking. And what really changes things is the escalation for this milieu is the escalation of the civil rights movement. And so, you know, I, when I did an oral history with Horowitz, I pulled up this quote that she said. She said, you know, quote, "I remember telling Fred Shuttlesworth that I had not voted for John F. Kennedy. You would have thought I would have come from Mars. By 1964, we had realized that this was not, if you wanted to sit in a loft in New York City and discuss politics, this was fine, but it was not something anybody in the civil rights movement could stand." So, you know, what she saw is that the civil rights movement was not about, and the broader Black community was not about to break from the Democratic Party and, you know, at any kind of foreseeable moment. And so, you know, the kind of, especially after the 63 March on Washington, it's just, you know, for activists like these, it's like, you know, we're on the realignment track as a matter of course. And so, you know, regardless of what you, you know, kind of might think, you know, should have been done or would be done or things like that. That was the course that history chose and individuals chose through their relative allegiance to the Democratic Party.
So the idea was to use like the civil rights movement as a wedge issue to sort of break the Democratic Party and turn it into either a socialist party or to break it sufficiently that a socialist party could emerge.
Or something akin, I think, to a Labor Party, if not formal, you know, a formal socialist party, or at least something that could be a vehicle for social democratic policy.
We're sort of in a moment of realignment today, or at least people are talking about it, strategizing about it. I was wondering if you thought that there were any continuities from the 60s debates to today, or mistakes we could learn from, or is that not the kind of thing that historical analysis allows us to do?
Well, I'll say a few things. One, I think, you know, right this second, the Republican Party's efforts to curtail voting rights really show how a voting rights struggle and an economic justice struggle can and must go hand in hand, as well as the need to get rid of what many are calling aptly the Jim Crow filibuster. It's really difficult to envision how you're going to get 60 votes, you know, with the Jim Crow filibuster as it is. And I think seeing how both the filibuster, but also broader Southern Dixiecrat white supremacist power articulated itself in the legislative process throughout the history I look at, seeing how that, you know, was a critical impediment to economic justice, to policy that would create economic justice time after time after time, that, you know, these struggles lost not because, you know, it was, they did, you know, the ideas were bad or the policy, you know, was undermined. It was like, how were you going to get this through Wilbur Mills's House Ways and Means Committee? How are you going to get this through John McClellan's filibuster? You know, these very particular roadblocks to public policy. And so I think we very much see echoes of that, or, you know, people who have grabbed the baton from John McClellan, politicians who have grabbed the baton from John McClellan and Wilbur Mills and in today's policy. You know, I've been privileged to be a part of some of the policymaking process, you know, with, you know, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, and we helped, I helped write the, what was introduced in February of this year, job guarantee House resolution. I think one of the lessons that my historical work shows is that there are very few legislative windows when a House, Senate, and presidency might line up to pass robust policy that could create economic justice, especially around labor markets, like a job, like a federal job guarantee. And it's incredibly important to be as prepared as possible when those, for activists and organizers to be as prepared as possible when those things might align. And so I think, you know, when I look historically, there were basically a handful of windows when something like this could have been passed, 1944 to 46, 1964 to 66, 1976 to 78, you know, you could put a big asterisk between 2008 to 2010. And I think, you know, now we might be in one of those moments. And one of the things we see historically is that when those windows shut, they can shut really hard and be very hard to open the window again. And so I would love to be wrong. I would love for this window to be open for, you know, this legislative window to be open for many, many years. But I'm nervous about what could happen when this window closes and a lack of progress on some of these efforts. While at the same time, I was incredibly honored to be part of those job guarantee revivification efforts. And I think when I looked back at the history, what we put together with this job guarantee resolution is the most robust effort in those lines since 1985. So there'd been this long lull. This policy had been relatively dormant, kept alive by activists, 85, by activists, heterodox economists, people like that. But this policy that had once been at the mainstream of the Democratic Party, a dominant moral value for so many, had been kind of stuffed into a sack and locked in a closet. For also incredibly heartened that I'm seeing increasingly more and more policies like a federal job guarantee be discussed within Capitol Hill. It was, you know, part of what kind of shaped this dissertation was writing in the wake of 2008 and trying to understand, you know, why this wasn't on the table in the way in which it would have in prior decades. And so, you know, I've been heartened to see that it now is on the table. And I hope it can and will continue. And I think, you know, the lessons for today from this historical work is like, we got to move with a sense of urgency because these windows can close and close and close quickly.
Yeah, Nick, Robert and I were talking a little bit about this earlier before you came on, but it seemed like, you know, in this first moment of realignment in the 60s, what really kind of splinters the left and sort of tanks, you know, all these, I think, really good ideas like the freedom budget is really foreign policy and Vietnam and sort of, I guess, also the presence of a labor bureaucracy in the Meniite AFL-CIO and sort of the left forces that either align with kind of the bureaucracy versus kind of the new left. I guess I'm more hopeful for today, unless we have a new Cold War with China. I know Nick's been thinking about Taiwan a lot recently, that these really difficult, I think, foreign policy issues and sort of trade-offs between domestic and foreign policy might not be so over-determining today as it was in the 60s in the era of Vietnam. Yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on sort of, I guess, what kind of killed the momentum that the early 60s seemed to be carrying forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. You know, I have a lot of the scholarship on the freedom budget argues or suggests that it was done in by its refusal to take a side on military spending. I have a different interpretation, which is that, you know, which is somewhat unsatisfactory, but I think nonetheless is the correct one, which is that it was much more done in by timing, you know, and the 1966 midterm elections, and that, you know, by the time they really got the freedom budget campaign off the ground, it was, I think, a handful of days before the 66 midterm elections, which are, you know, go very poorly for the Democratic Party. And the potential to shape a policy like this between 66 and 68, you know, is not really possible in that congressional cycle. I think, you know, I have a quote somewhere where one of LBJ's aides says, like, you know, he couldn't get a Mother's Day passed during that period. You know, like, it was, you know, all the things we remember LBJ around in terms of legislatively, you know, those are passed between 63 and 66, you know. And so
the argument that it's about Vietnam War spending is an argument about like limited fiscal space or something like this, right? Like, am I right about that?
It's twofold. Okay. There's an element of that, but I think what I see more in that is a kind of argument from, you know, with all due respect, because I'm politically sympathetic to it, but historically less so, to, you know, many historians who come out of the New Left, who I've been so inspired by, remember the way in which Rustin and their milieu were, for lack of a better term, reactionary towards a lot of new left politics and anti-war politics. And they see the refusal to take a side on military spending as a compromise with the military establishment. Whereas Rustin and that and Kaiserling, they would have seen it as, they understood it at the time as, you know, we're trying to pass legislation, not make this a referendum on the Vietnam War or the Cold War. And that is not interpreted among, and as the war ratchets up, those issues become more and more pronounced. So, you know, you, I think, you know, the great historian and scholar Staunton Lind, who, you know, I admire tremendously, at one point calls the freedom budget and calls Rustin's politics coalitional politics with the Marines, you know? And so there's a vociferous debate along these lines. And I think a lot of scholars have looked back and seen the freedom budget as insufficiently radical, as because it didn't take a stand on military spending, and that because of that, it couldn't galvanize the anti-war movement in the way in which it would have needed to pass it. I see it as, it's just hard for me to imagine the kind of left coalitional agitation that would have been needed to pass it between 66 and 68, no matter what. Like, they could have said, you know, this is an anti-war document, we're against the military Keynesianism and against military spending. It's still hard for me to envision, you know, where they get those votes in Congress in 1967. And so that's where I would, you know, disagree historically with some of that interpretation, which I think, you know, comes a little bit from, comes from people's, you know, righteous indignation with, you know, the Vietnam War and with the politics around military spending.
Interesting. So there, it was kind of a no-win situation, whether you were, whether you tried to sideline the war and just focus on domestic issues, you got accused of being pro-war. And if you were anti-war explicitly, you might have galvanized the base, but that might just not have been enough in that particular cycle.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's, these are some of the cruelties of history and the cruelties of timing. And if you could have told Rustin and Horowitz and Randolph and Kaiserling how this stuff would play out in 1965, maybe you could have got them to say, you know, okay, we're not going to argue about, you know, what images we're going to use in the freedom budget and just, you know, put this out ASAP and, you know, get on the line. They'd hope that Jacob Javits and Bobby Kennedy might sponsor it as a bill, you know, kind of, you know, work in that effort more significantly. You know, the other thing, you know, Horowitz said to me, she's lived in DC for a very long time, has a good idea of how things work. She said that they, in her interpretation, they lacked the kind of robust lobbying arm that the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights had. And they, you know, kind of had that, but the civil rights movement, you know, was nominally fully on board with the freedom budget. But at least in her estimation, they didn't have the kind of lobbying arm that she wishes that they would have had in hindsight, knowing what she, you know, knowing what she knows after, you know, a lifetime spent in and around DC. So I think those are some of the kind of complicated dynamics. The other thing to remember, and I was thinking about this earlier when we were talking about the Dixiecrat power, is, you know, it's not like Jim Crow political power, especially in Congress, ends with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. You know, I think, you know, we see this very acutely today. But, you know, people like Wilbur Mills, John McClellan, Robert Byrd, they retain power in DC. Many of them are brought down by scandal or disgrace, not, or death, not democratic challenge, right? And so, you know, a lot of them retain their power on congressional committees way after 1965. And I think, you know, when we're really looking at how social justice and grassroots movements engage in the political process, we need to look as scholars and historians. I think, you know, I'm, you know, informed by scholars who have trained their gaze at Congress. And I think sometimes you know, our focus on the presidency limits what's in our view politically.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about, because you mentioned Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition in your conclusion, and it seems to be like a similar sort of, convergence of different concerns and movements. And I guess as I was reading the conclusion just this morning, it reminded me, I think Mike Davis writes about this a little bit, but he's pretty harsh on Mike Harrington and kind of the DSA, I guess, of the 80s for supporting Mondale over Jesse Jackson in 84. And he sort of sees this as almost like a continuation of some of the failings from the 60s. And he's especially harsh, I think, because Jesse Jackson was very anti-interventionist, and he seemed to be able to offer a program that was sort of very critical of US intervention in Central America, while also having this expansive social democratic vision domestically. That seemed to be like a through line, I guess, from the 60s moment to the 80s. But I was wondering if you had any thoughts about what happened in the 80s that really, you know, made Jackson's proposal so powerful, and why the left maybe failed to latch onto it. I don't know.
Yeah, the Jackson, especially the Jackson 84 campaign, is really important. And you know, this dissertation is going to be a book. And you know, in the chapter on the 1980s, the Jackson 84 campaign is really important to it. And the choices of Mondale, especially for the history that you all have done on this show and what you all are working on, Mondale runs as a deficit hawk, right? And that can't be kind of, you know, apologized for. And he has no real, you know, people like Thomas Ferguson have talked about this. You know, he has no real jobs plan in his policy, so he doesn't give people a lot of reason to vote for him, especially after, you know, just the brutal economic policies of Reaganism, the brutal austerity, the punishing interest rates, the punishing unemployment rates, you know. And there had been, you know, one thing that I was really blown away by in researching and writing that chapter is how much political agitation there is in the early 1980s, how much protest there are to Reagan's food stamp cuts, how much protest there are to, you know, the various kinds of Central American interventions and the kind of Cold War policies of that period. And I think, you know, the Jackson 84 campaign really becomes a vehicle for those desires and those demands, and also becomes a vehicle for voting rights, you know. And so, you know, he's doing, at his rallies, they're doing mass voter registration, you know, at the rallies and things like that. And so Jackson 84, I think, really held a tremendous amount of potential, and the failure, refusal of, you know, groups like Social Democrats USA, but also, you know, broadly the AFL-CIO to you know, see what was possible with the Jackson candidacy, I think was a real error, and one that, you know, that many people have paid for. You know, I think, you know, it's always tough to do kind of counterfactual sort of things. But I think, you know, Mondale's policies around the deficit, you can see a lot of the early the Democratic Leadership Council is getting organized during that period. While Mondale's not of that milieu, you know, he's taking advice from Robert Rubin. You know, we see Robert Rubin and that milieu getting their inroads in the Democratic Party in that moment. And you see it articulate itself with that deficit hawkery. And so I think, knock on every piece of wood I have, some of that deficit hawkery is waning right now. I think, you know, we still see it articulate itself right now in some of the debates that are happening within the Biden administration of, you know, wanting to make some of the Build Back Gender, the Build Back Better agenda, you know, all the kind of how are you going to pay for it questions. And I think, you know, it's really, it's tough. You know, I have a Augustus Hawk, Congressman Augustus Hawkins, the founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus and a leader of the, you know, the, one of the key authors of the 1978 Humphrey Hawkins Act, you know, has a quote in the early 80s, I think 83, where he says, you know, 2 years ago, they said we couldn't have jobs. We couldn't deal with unemployment. We couldn't have jobs programs because of inflation. Now they say we can't have job programs because of the deficit. And so, you know, I think, you know, Hawkins, one thing I also came away with from my research is that, you know, Hawkins is really an important and visionary legislator. So Augustus Hawkins is the congressman from Watts, and from Watts, California. He becomes a founding member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and he's a leader on workers' rights and racial justice. So he's one of the lead authors of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 64, which prohibits employment discrimination. He took his inspiration for that and credits people like A. Philip Randolph and the March on Washington movement with that effort towards you know, eradicating employment discrimination. And in the 1970s, one thing he sees coming from his district, looking at what was going on, is that there needs to be a governmental guarantee to a job. And he begins writing and what would become the 1978 Humphrey Hawkins Employment Act, co-sponsored by Senator Hubert Humphrey. And, you know, the early, like lots of legislation, by the time it gets passed, it's much watered down and not what it could have been. But in the early drafts, it had things like a guaranteed job office, you know, sort of like your local post office, where you could show up and say, you know, I care for my mother 3 days a week, but I'd like to work 30 hours a week, 4 days a week. What do you have for me? And the job guarantee office would say, here, you know, what are your skills? We have, you know, this, you know, local mural project, you know, on the back of this library. Would you like to be involved in that? Well, sure thing, you know, and they set to work for, you know, 30 hours a week doing that job, you know. And he was also, you know, he both was a part of, you know, visionary legislation like this, but he also was a key, one of the key people behind this Comprehensive Employment Training Act, which was the last federal governmental major public service employment legislation from the 1970s to the early 1980s, which Reagan got rid of. But at its height, employed 750,000 people, doing things like helping weatherize homes for low-income and low-wealth people and for renters, which was especially important during a time of high energy prices. You also had people employed by the Comprehensive Employment Training Act, you know, former jazz musicians doing jazz education in public schools in Philadelphia. You had people right near me in Pasadena learning gardening skills and learning floral design and things like that. So there's, you know, the types of policies that, you know, I think the Green New Deal, you know, turns up the volume on. Hawkins was a visionary legislator around some of those policies in the 1970s and from the 60s through the 80s. He was a visionary legislator on those sets of policies, and someone who, you know, I think has not gotten their historical due, part due to a variety of reasons. And I hope this project can rectify some of that. One thing I see in the 80s, especially even when, you know, even at the height of Reaganism, he's still able to squeeze some jobs programs out of the Reagan administration. And when you when you do social history of unemployed people, like I try and do in this project, you see how, you know, every single job matters. Every single job is a person's family. You know, the violence of unemployment is so immense. And, you know, things like that, that get, you know, 60,000 public sector jobs here, 80,000 public sector jobs there, those really, really matter and are nothing to sneeze at, especially in arduous environments. And I think, you know, for me, really shaped my thinking about, for lack of a better term, the dialectics between reform and revolution.
Right. That's yeah, I didn't know any of those things about Hawkins. That's if one would believe listening to like the MMTers that the job guarantee was invented by Hyman Minsky, like in the 80s. Yeah, that's fascinating bit of legislative history.
I think there's these robust. I was just going to say on the MMT point, you know, there's these robust intersecting traditions of between, especially Black social movement commitments to a job guarantee and a kind of, you know, someone like Minsky as well, and I think, you know, Keicherling, who you know has a slightly different tradition than say Minsky, I think would probably be the kind of Venn diagram between those two crossovers.
You in the introduction to your dissertation, you quote E.P. Thompson saying that by uncovering lost causes of prior social movements, you may discover insights into social evils that we have yet to cure. And you mentioned earlier that you have helped introduce legislation today. So can you tell us a little bit more about the legislative process that you've been involved in?
What's in the bill? Right now it's a House resolution, so it's not a full bill. And it calls for a governmental guarantee to a job which emphasizes social needs and draws on some of this history. So it, you know, to guide it, especially work like Randolph and Randolph's, Rustin's, Coretta Scott King's, as well as The Economist, Sadie Alexander. And I've been a part of that process with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley in her office. We're currently seeking co-sponsors for the resolution, and hopefully, you know, we'll be developing it into a full bill. And I've been, you know, working a lot on that alongside people within the Modern Money Network, as well as groups like Policy Link, as well as, you know, leading economists like Derek Hamilton and Nina Banks. And so I think, you know, it's been, as you know, all of the listeners who are historians know, it's a rare gift to see our work inform the present in a way that can build better and better livelihoods and for the world that we want to see. And so it's been, you know, it's been beyond an honor to be able to engage in some of that process with some of those illustrious and wonderful allies and comrades who I said earlier. And I think the other thing that I would say about that is I was really informed historically by the long civil rights literature, the literature on the long civil rights movement, and also seeing activists within the civil rights movement talk about their disappointments and failures in discrete historical moments. So, you know, there's a moment right after the March on Washington where Rustin is just, it's about a month after the March on Washington, the Birmingham killings of the Birmingham bombings, church bombing has just happened. And he's just devastated. And he says, you know, where are we winning this fight, my friends? We're losing everywhere. You know, he doesn't say, you know, I just organized one of the greatest protests in all of US history. He sees a civil rights bill that's stagnating. You know, he sees, you know, this awful white supremacist violence breaking out. And he doesn't know that the civil rights bill is going to pass, the voting rights bill is going to pass. He doesn't know that when he's giving this speech in September 63. And so I've been informed by all of that to know that, you know, as I wrote in a piece about Coretta Scott King, you know, a moment of victory can recast suddenly a past history of losses. And so these activists, I think, sowed seeds that needed time and cultivation to eventually flower. And the moment they succeed, the moment we succeed, the moment any of these bills pass, suddenly that history of struggle around these issues looks very different than, you know, at the most pessimistic, you might read it as a history of failure. But then suddenly when something passes, you see it as, oh, these people were, they tilled this soil, they planted the seeds, they did this gardening. And so, you know, similarly, you know, the long civil rights literature really taught me to understand that, you know, activism that was done in the 1930s and 40s helped create the context for the 1950s, 60s victories. And so, you know, and that the dialectics of struggle continue after, you know, and so I was really informed by, you know, the Thompson quote you read, the long civil rights literature, as well as looking at, you know, one way I've taught it to my students is, you know, activists might fight for 10 things in a given movement and win 2 or 3. And so I was really interested in, well, what happens to those 7 or 8 other demands? And how do, you know, so many activists continue on that road, even if they, you know, didn't yet win those 6, 7, 8 demands?
Yeah, I think that's a great note to end on. History takes unexpected turns and a counsel to sobriety and long-term thinking, because in the end, you know, we'll win. All right, David Stein, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you about some of the most central things we could have talked about on this podcast. So hope to talk to you again when that article comes out.
Likewise. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. The podcast is supported financially by the University of Chicago Program for Professional Advancement and Training for Humanists and Humanistic Social Scientists. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.